Orva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kauffman.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Say it loud! I'm black and I'm proud!
Imagine yourself a child turned away from schools, stores, and restaurants because you're black.
You didn't like it, but you just learned to live with it.
Champaign residents Irma Bridgewater and Ruby Hunt grew up in the 1920s and 40s in segregated America, coping with discrimination. Youth Media Workshop, a service of Illinois Public Media, presents I Remember, I Believe, Mondays and Tuesdays in June at 4:45 and 6:45 p.m.
This is WILL Radio. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of central and southern Illinois and surrounding states effective this Tuesday afternoon and evening until 8 p.m. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Logan, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, Shelby, and Vermilion. Repeating, a severe thunderstorm watch in effect for portions of central and southern Illinois until 8 p.m. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Teenage boys have a bad press, behavior problems, bad grades, depression, drug abuse. Journalist Melina Saval thinks the so-called boy crisis is overblown, however. Among other things, she points to data indicating a hopeful outlook, including increasing graduation rates, rising SAT scores, and declining drug use and crime rates. Data aside, Saval says spending time listening to and talking with boys is overall an uplifting experience, offering optimism for the future. Saval wrote a cover story on the topic of teenage boys for the LA Weekly. That story became a book. The title, The Secret Lives of Boys, Inside the Raw Emotional World of Male Teens. Saval's book is an in-depth portrait of 10 boys with whom she spent anywhere from 4 months to 2 years observing and interviewing them. She says they surprised her and worried her and made her laugh. At the conclusion of her book, she says this: "All boys, I discovered, in their stories and in their lives, have secrets to tell us, if we listen." Melina Saval is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for her. I look forward to your questions and comments. Perhaps you'd share your experiences as or with a teenage boy. Here are our phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area: 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Melina Saval's work has appeared in numerous publications. Her book, The Secret Lives of Boys, is published by Basic Books. You'll find her online at www.melinasaval.com. Her name spelled M-A-L-I-N-A and Saval, S-A-V. A-L. Again, our phone numbers, if you'd like to join our discussion, 333-9455, that's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Melina Saval, welcome. Good to talk with you. And we've got a problem. We'll fix that right away. Hopefully, we'll get our guest on the phone here. I don't know what's going on, but we'll find out what the problem is. Melina Saval, our guest this afternoon. She's the author of The Secret Lives of Boys, Inside the Raw Emotional World of Male Teens. And perhaps at this point, I can tell you what's coming up later this afternoon on this radio station. Coming up today on The World, North Korea's imprisonment of two American journalists is more than a humanitarian concern. It's also about the standoff over North Korea's nukes. Releasing the women might show Pyongyang is ready to return to nuclear negotiations. But if they receive harsh treatment, North Korea may instead be burning its diplomatic bridges. That story in the day's news coming up today on The World here on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2, as well as online at will.illinois.edu. And we're off to a little bit of a slow start, a little bit of a bumpy start here this afternoon in this portion of the afternoon magazine. But we now have our guest journalist, Melina Saval, on the line. She's the author of The Secret Lives of Boys, Inside the Raw Emotional World of Male Teens. Her book is an in-depth portrait of 10 boys with whom she spent anywhere from 4 months to 2 years observing and interviewing them. She says they surprised her and worried her and made her laugh. At the conclusion of her book, The Secret Lives of Boys, she says this: "All boys, I discovered, in their stories and in their lives, have secrets to tell us if we listen." Melina Saval is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to join our discussion this afternoon. Melina Saval, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you select the boys to interview?
I selected the boys. It started with one boy. There was one boy. He was 14 years old when we met, and I became a mentor to him. He was assisting me in a class that I taught. And we hung out, and I discovered that he had a lot of fascinating stories to tell me that he had, you know, that nobody else knew about, that he hadn't really told his mom, that he hadn't necessarily told his friends. And the culture was so saturated by books and movies and TV shows about young women, teenage girls. And I thought, this is interesting. This is a whole kind of subculture that has not yet been tapped into, and wouldn't it be interesting to explore? So it really started from one boy, and it went from there. After that, I found boys through various different means. I would contact old professors that maybe, you know, that worked in education. I contacted family members. I cold called schools all over the country. It really just came from a lot of, you know, hardcore investigative journalism tracking them down.
Okay. And so these boys represent a spectrum of young men from across the country in different backgrounds.
They do. I thought it was important, obviously, to find boys whereby any mom, any teacher, any guidance counselor, any teenage girl or any boy could open the pages and find at least some aspect of himself within the pages of the book. And so I wanted to get boys from different socioeconomic, different cultural backgrounds, different religious backgrounds, from different walks of life. Ultimately, you can't include every single boy in America. But what I ended up coming up with were 10 boys that I felt represented some core qualities that we see among American boyhood culture today.
Yeah. All very different individuals, but as we talk this afternoon, we'll see some themes emerge about what's important to young men.
Absolutely. I think that what was most interesting to me was that a lot of these boys, in fact, all of these boys felt a similar sense of not belonging, a similar sense of isolation, a sense that they didn't fit in anywhere. And so in this collective sense of not having a place where they really belonged, they actually had a bond between them that they weren't even aware of. All of the boys in the book, at some point or another within their chapter, say, I have a version in their, you know, that they say, I don't know many other boys like me. And I so wanted to get all these boys together so that they could meet one another, you know, in a room, maybe at a party or something, so they could understand that all of these boys felt that same way. And they can actually learn quite a bit from one another. And that they actually have a tremendous amount of things in common despite their different backgrounds, you know, despite their socioeconomic differences and cultural differences. And just because one boy is from, you know, has a dad in a gang in East L.A. and another boy grew up very wealthy in Manhattan doesn't mean that they don't have a lot of things in common.
Yeah. And overall, the way that we connect with these boys is that we also feel a need for connection.
Absolutely. The more I think about this book, and I think as a writer, a lot of times you don't really have a chance to absorb what you're writing about until after it's written, and then you get a chance to go back and read the book and then gauge people's reactions. And what I now truly feel about this book is not that it's necessarily, or shall I say, exclusively a story about teenage boys, but really a story about humanity. Some people have come up to me and they're relating to certain chapters of the book, and they are not a boy, they are not young, they're not a teenager anymore, they may be an adult, they may be a female adult in her 50s who relates quite closely to a certain chapter because this boy exhibits certain qualities that they too possess or that they want to possess or they can identify with in some way. So really it's a book about human beings, about people, about not belonging, about loneliness, about resilience, about isolation, about all of those feelings. And yes, they are manifested and portrayed in this particular book through these teenage boys, but really there are attributes of all of these boys that we can all learn from and admire, and there's a takeaway, I think, regardless of the gender or age or socioeconomic background or where you live. So even if you're not a teenager, a great deal of people that have connected even the most closely to this book have been people that are no longer in their teens and not necessarily boys. Hmm. So that's been really interesting and really gratifying for me.
Yeah. The boy that started this all, we'll call him the Indy.
Right.
That's all we can do on the radio.
Yes.
His name is Apollo Lev, or at least that's what you call him in the book. And this was interesting because it came through in not only his story, but in some of the other boys' story, this sense of being old, a sense of loss. And Apollo told you there are two kinds of teenagers, main kinds, because he had some other groups, old spirits and everyone else. What did he mean?
I think if you're an old spirit, there's a sense that life is sort of stale, that you become old before your time, you know, that the world is already a very kind of, as I said before, a very stale place to be. The magic is gone. They feel, you know, they may be 15 in chronological years, but they feel 30 or 45. There's a sense of being worn down, of weariness, of fatigue. And those particular boys tend to be intellectual, tend to be incredibly bright, tend to be interested in art and film, tend to be, I use this phrase throughout my book, emotional sieves. Everything sticks. They're highly emotional creatures. And you know, their world can be quite heavy. And everyone else, according to Apollo in this chapter, are those people who don't really feel this sense of you know, being weighed down, of loneliness, of disconnectedness. And I don't think he means it in any sort of disparaging way. I think for him, the sense of being an old spirit comes as a burden in a lot of respects. He takes life very seriously, and I think that we all know people like this. And I think that I set out in this book to debunk as many stereotypes as I possibly could about teenage boyhood culture in America. And I think what Apollo in this particular chapter illustrates is that the whole notion that boys do not feel, the whole notion that boys are closed off emotionally, is absolutely not true. And as an old spirit, he feels everything. And he's, you know, he is traveling around this earth, observing and taking it all in, and just trying to, you know, muddle through his existence in the best way that he possibly can. And so the whole notion that boys are just immune to things going on around them and don't care and aren't communicative creatures is absolutely false.
Tell us about the changes you saw in him over time.
Well, I first have to point out that I'm still in touch with this particular person today, and he actually was at a book reading that I recently did in Los Angeles. So I'm still seeing his progression. And he said one remarkable thing when he read his chapter, when he first saw it, the completed chapter about, you know, 2 months ago. He said, and I'm paraphrasing here, he said, "It's really interesting because I'm so different now than when I was then. But everything you wrote is extremely," I think he might have said 100% true for the person I was at that time, meaning he captured a time, you know, of his youth, or I captured a time. And, you know, when I first met him, he was a recovering methamphetamine addict at the age of 14. He'd spent, I think it was 92 or 94 days in a detox center. He came out, he was dealing with just sobriety and going through the world in a different way than he had before. Life literally slowed down because he'd been on speed. And he's since graduated from high school. He's since gone off to college. He's since struggled with his addiction. He's gone through various girlfriends. He's gone through various different tastes in books and clothes. He's gone through different points of views, different perspectives through which he sees the world. He's gone from sometimes a very, you know, place of dark cynicism to joy, to enthusiasm, to ennui, to boredom. He's changing all the time, just as we all are. And he's just one of the smartest, brightest individuals that I've ever met, teenage boy or adult. And we still keep in touch. So as we all do, every day he's changing and becoming a different person and just going through this world and trying to figure out how he fits.
Yeah. How did he tell you about this process? How did he explain it? How did he express it? What were his thoughts about finding oneself and finding friends?
Well, you know, we talked about it the same way, you know, I would talk to anyone. And I think actually that's an important point. I think a lot of people wanted to know, how did I talk to these boys? I talked to them as though they were people. I mean, we were spending a lot of time together over the course of, it was 2 years for the purpose of the book, and now it's going on, you know, 3.5. We would meet, and he would tell me about different friends that he made and friendships that were going well and friendships that weren't going well. And we talk about it over lunch, and we talk about it over going to a movie. And I'm in touch with his mother, and she would tell me what she's seeing, and then, you know, he would tell me what he was seeing through his perspective. And just the same way, you know, you would talk to anyone else, sometimes there would be lapses in communication, just as sometimes there would be lapses of communication with anyone. And, you know, we would be hanging out, and he'd be telling me about this fabulous girl he was seeing, and then, you know, 2 months later, suddenly he could, you know, oh, no, that girl's been gone, and now I'm with this other person, or now I'm alone. It was a very kind of casual, conversational approach. I didn't approach these boys with necessarily any preconceived notions of who they were, although I'm only human, and sometimes my preconceived notions, of course, were challenged, but I really tried to keep an open mind when I spoke to them. And also, I changed as a person. When I started this book, I was a very different person than where I was when I finished it. So we kind of, as trite and corny as it might sound, we really grew together, me and all of the subjects in this book. I think in a lot of ways it's a memoir of my experience with these teenage boys.
Hmm. How involved were the parents in this project, and what did they think of the idea at the outset?
They were extremely involved. For legal reasons, with the exception of one boy who was 19, all of the boys in this book were under the age of 18 when we started. They all had to sign legal releases. The parents all had to sign off. Some of the parents were enthusiastic. All of them obviously had their concerns about their children being in a book. What was I going to say? What were their friends going to think when the book came out? What were their boys going to say about them? Were they going to bash them? Were they going to say, make any disparaging remarks? So they were very involved in that process. Some were more involved than others because some of them, their parents were more involved in their daily lives than others. I mean, some of these kids really, you know, they never saw their dads. Some of these kids, their mothers were working full-time and really didn't have the time to speak to me on the phone. So it really was a reflection of how involved they were in their child's life on a day-to-day basis. Some of the moms and I are still in touch. Some of them I never really met other than just getting their signed release in the mail. There's one example of a boy who, after the chapter was written, the day before I was passing this manuscript into my editor, the parents read the chapter and said, you know what, we changed our minds, you cannot print this. And what's interesting about that is that particular boy was an honor student, was going to one of the top-ranked colleges in the country, on paper, pretty much your dream kid. And they just freaked out. They were not ready to have their child talk about the way he felt about them in a book. He wasn't saying anything, you know, even just outlandish in the slightest way, but he was talking honestly about his feelings for his parents, and sometimes he didn't like so much of who they were, and he was a little critical of the way they had dealt with a lot of things that he was going through, namely getting into the college process because they had not gone to college themselves. And they were just from a certain town in a certain place in the United States where they just did not want their son to talk about them and they didn't want their friends to read about it. So I actually had to replace that chapter. So that's an example of a parent that was so involved and just so involved in terms of how this would affect them that at the last second they decided that their son could not participate in this book and I had to find another subject. So. Challenging in that respect, absolutely.
Yeah. Overall, it strikes me that most of the parents, with the exception, the real standout exception is Manny's dad, that they're supportive, and the kids, even though, you know, it's tough work,
right.
Parenting, and it's tough work absolutely. Growing up. But it seems that the kids and the parents, even though there are these moments, there are difficulties, there are tensions, there are conflicts, that most of the kids have quite a great deal of respect for their parents.
Absolutely. And even the subject that I just mentioned, who at the last second wasn't in the book, for the most part, he had great admiration for his parents. And I think we're all... I don't know if guilty is the right word, but we've all been in a place where we get angry and we get resentful and we have to emote. And then a few days later, we think about it and say, maybe I shouldn't have said that, or maybe I didn't quite mean that. And I found a lot of the times that was the case with these boys. And for the most part, they had a great deal of respect for their parents and love and admiration. And in fact, in the chapter called The Troublemaker, which you haven't mentioned, but this is a particular chapter of a boy that you know, one has to read it to really get the full sense of what's going on here, but he's been pegged as a troublemaker his whole life, and sort of falsely pegged as a troublemaker because he has a lot of problems going on that are misunderstood and I think prejudged. But he even has a moment in the chapter where he says, none of this is his mom's fault. In fact, he could never be where he is without his mother. And so the whole notion that kids are just, teenage boys are just rebellious, that they're doing all of this to get back at their parents, is, in my experience, for the most part, not true at all. And per these boys, not true at all. And they all, you know, they're all very grateful that their parents have stuck around,
yeah.
Frankly. And obviously there's exceptions where, as you said in the Optimist chapter, that subject, Manny, his dad is not around. His mom, in spite of the fact that she's not perfect, he clearly has love for her and is appreciative that she's even still there. So, and that was really nice to see. A lot of these boys, I mean, and you know, you could talk about the whole, whatever, the Freudian implication of boys and their moms, but I think it's definitely true that, especially the moms, these boys had a great deal of affection for them.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Melina Saval. She's the author of The Secret Lives of Boys, Inside the Raw Emotional World of Male Teens. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Perhaps you'd share your experiences as or with a teenage boy, as a parent or another caring adult. Here are our phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And we have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, tell us a little bit about Nicholas, the troublemaker. He calls his mother amazing. One of the things that he did that you write about here is that he told you a story about being hit by a stray bullet. Quite the story. It wasn't true. But here you say sometimes kids will offer creative versions of the truth. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, I'm glad that you pointed out that example because I think the point to be made is that, yes, people lie. Teenage boys lie. And a lot of times kids lie just because they hear their parents lying. It's just, you know, they're getting that from whoever they're hearing around them that's doing the same thing. But this particular boy was lying because his whole life he's been pegged as a troublemaker, and he has certain psychological problems, psychiatric problems, that have contributed to his behavior. But very rarely did anyone really listen to what was going on and really observe what was truly going on, and so they jumped to these conclusions. And after a while, he just decided to meet their expectations. If people at his school were thinking that he was a drug addict, he was going to pretend he was a drug addict. He was going to play them at their own game. If people thought that he was running around involved with all these bad sorts of people and, you know, people in gangs and people with guns, and he was going to become that person because he was so frustrated that nobody was listening to what was really going on. So he concocted this whole story. He concocted several stories. One of them is that he was shot in a way he had just given up at trying to explain what really happened. So when people made assumptions, he just said, okay, you're absolutely right. And that was one example of that. And I think, you know, it just shows how sometimes if we leap to conclusions about boys, it's extremely harmful because then they give up at really trying to explain what's really going on. Mm-hmm. And so we can't learn about who they actually are. And that can be dangerous.
Melina Saval is our guest this afternoon. She's the author of The Secret Lives of Boys. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Good afternoon. I have from the standpoint, give you a little background here, I have two grown sons, and I am not at all sure that I would have consented this kind of research. And it begs the question, do you think that may have manipulated or used these boys in any way?
Absolutely not. And it's interesting you use the word manipulate, because I think even in my introduction, I talk about how the word manipulate, or I use that exact word, I put that word to some parents who had that similar fear. I absolutely did not manipulate these boys. In fact, I made it quite clear that I was a curious journalist, interested in the topic, interested in finding out what they had to say. I did not go in with any preconceived notions. And obviously, if I did, I didn't, you know, I had to work hard to put them at bay. I really put myself in a position whereby I wanted to hear what they had to say. I let these boys talk to me. And for a lot of these boys, nobody had ever said, I want to hear what you have to say. Let's chat. Tell me what's going on in your world. For a lot of these boys, their parents had never said that to them, or even their teachers. So it was an amazing opportunity for them to just tell me about who they were. I, you know, as a journalist in general, you go in, and a lot of times you don't know the story when you start out. The story comes to you. And that's very much what happened in this particular example, this particular topic. And in fact, I didn't want to go in having all the answers, because then what's the point? Then you spend 2 years, you know, 3 years by the time you edit it on a book, and there's no growth. And I actually wanted to go in not knowing things, and I wanted to learn from them. And I think what you're expressing, that type of fear, is definitely something that came from a lot of parents, something that I respected, something that I worked hard to, you know, allay their fears, and I worked with them. And a lot of times there were parents, I talked to them quite often throughout the process of the book, and their parents, it's important to know, they were able to check their son's chapters and quotes prior to the publication. So again, as I mentioned, the one boy whose parents said, no, you can't be in this book, they all had the opportunity to say, no, we don't want our kids in this book. But what happened was most of the parents, I mean all of them in this book, read what their son had said, their quotes, and in fact, one particular mom said, and I paraphrase, I feel like I just met my kid. And it was an eye-opening experience for them. So they were grateful to hear that I had discovered certain things about their sons that they may not have known. I mean, it was fascinating for them.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Melina Saval, author of The Secret Lives of Boys. And let me take a moment here to remind our listeners that a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Logan, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, Shelby, Vermilion, those counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area until 8 p.m. tonight. It's 1:38 Central Time. Listeners, if you'd like to join us, join our conversation about boys this afternoon, teenage boys, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. How do the lives of these boys differ from those their parents experienced 20, 30 years ago?
You're asking me, correct?
Yep.
Yeah, it's like maybe there's someone on the phone. I think that they differ in so many ways. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is just all the technological, you know, advances going on there. I mean, the, you know, parents, people 20, 30 years ago, even 10 years ago, did not have to deal on the same level with cyberbullying, where people could actually slam your reputations on Facebook and MySpace and Twitter and just all the other different, you know, electronic pathways that are out there of communication. And a lot of these boys, you know, you're hitting on a point, a lot of them, without exception, all said to me, we definitely want our parents to talk to us. We absolutely do. But what we do not want is for them to be guessing wrong, meaning we do not want our parents to sit down and say that same stock quote, we know what it's like to be young. We were young once, too. They understand that, of course. That's a given. That's obvious. But they or we or you were not young at the same time as these boys. So you did not have to deal with the same mental stimuli out there. And that does create a difference. You know, there's so many different ways of communicating today. It's kind of an emotional free-for-all. Mm. At the same time, that can be quite overwhelming for a boy. It becomes very busy and noisy out there. And so he doesn't just have to deal with people slamming his reputation, you know, in the high school hallways. He has to deal with people writing, you know, things about him online, and that can be quite disconcerting. So there are a lot of differences out there. I mean, there's brief talk of, you know, the threat of terrorism. You know, a few boys talked about that. Just, you know, some of these boys, I mean, just the environment is completely different. I mean, what we fear today in our culture and what we feared, you know, 20, 30 years ago is quite different. So they're just dealing with a different time. I mean, everything's different, the music, the clothes. And, you know, so it was, they appreciate people coming to them with similar feelings of having been young, but they really kind of resented when people assumed they understood what was going on now.
Mm-hmm.
They would have rather parents said, I was young, of course, and it was difficult. Youth can be absolutely crazy and mind-boggling and chaotic. But I wasn't young now, so what is it like? Mm. You have to deal with this? Well, I didn't have to deal with that. My God, that's an extra ingredient. That must be make things even crazier. So I would say that there's, you know, definitely differences, mostly in the way of technology, that I think added to sometimes their confusion.
Let's take another call. Another listener in Champaign, online too. Hi.
Hello. I must admit to it that having been a teenage boy once, there were still dinosaurs around at that time. In any case, one of the things that I noticed when I was a teenage boy, I was, I guess, what you'd call a loner. But I didn't mind being it. I thought it was kind of enjoyable. A few of my friends were that way, too. You know, they didn't date girls, and they weren't on the football team, and so on and so forth. And say, well, you know, we have our own interests and so on and so forth. But I have the feeling that the teenage boys of recent generations have a tendency to think of themselves as misfits if they're a loner. And I don't know whether you discovered that or not. The other thing I was going to point out is that I've always thought that it was easier to be a boy in those days than to be a girl, because a girl always had to be part of a social network. I mean, you didn't find loner girls around. If they were, they were probably extremely unhappy. I don't know whether that meets with your findings and expectations, but I'd just be curious to know. Do you think that being a loner today has a kind of a an unfortunate that boys get depressed about it, which I don't think we did so much 50 years ago.
Well, I love what you're saying. There's so much there. I mean, I could talk for hours just about your question, and I think it's a fabulous question. Number one, I think it, you know, there's a difference between being a loner and being alone, being lonely and being alone. A lot of these boys actually were quite comfortable in being loners. Absolutely. There's one boy, the optimist, and in his particular chapter, he's the type of boy that a lot of guys like because he sort of does his own thing, but he considers himself kind of a solo flyer, if you will. He's sort of a loner, and he's quite comfortable in that. He doesn't really feel like he fits in with a lot of people at school, but he's okay with that. And I also, it's interesting what you said about girls not being loners. I can only think about my own experience, and I absolutely felt like a loner. And I'm a girl, I'm a woman, so I definitely would definitely challenge you on that. I think that also what's important is the way you perceive yourself and the way others perceive you. I might consider myself a loner. Some of these boys might consider themselves to be loners because they feel that they are, you know, doing their own thing, but other boys might say, but wow, you have so many friends. So I actually think there's definitely a difference between how you consider yourself and how others consider you. I definitely think also to address your point about how boys not feeling like they need to belong to a particular crowd, I actually would challenge that. A lot of these boys, there were definitely pressures. I don't know if similar to girls, because I also want to point out my goal wasn't to do a girl versus boy exploration. It was really to focus on the boys, but I do know quite a bit about girls in addition. And I definitely felt that these boys were, you know, they were in certain groups and they had certain feelings about being in certain groups. And in fact, the whole Indie Blank chapter, that character Apollo talks quite extensively all about the different boys, the cliques and clans going on in his high school. So it's definitely an issue. But I'm just interested in the whole loner-verse lonely thing and being alone. And a lot of these boys they felt that they were loners. Some of them were okay with that and they felt quite comfortable in that. And some, you know, had a sense of being uncomfortable with people not understanding them or not feeling they had a place to fit in. But the whole loner idea, I think in certain respects, we all have a sense of feeling that way a little bit. I don't know if much has changed. I think people are people, and there's you can feel a sense of disconnectedness, and that doesn't feel so uncomfortable, but you can also feel okay with doing your own thing. And a lot of boys in this book were doing their own thing, and they were quite confident and okay about that. Well, so again, it's you asked a lot of different questions, and there's a lot
that's
going
good
on
to
there.
Hear. I'm glad to hear that that's the case.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, and a lot of these boys had a mature understanding about their, you know, quote unquote lonerness or being alone. They sort of took some pride in it. Actually, felt like they were doing their own thing, and they preferred it that way.
I guess some of the ideas we get about these things come from television documentaries and shows.
Absolutely.
In which. You know, you're not able to get into anything in any depth, so you show teenagers that are out of it or at a loss or something like that.
Right, and, you know, as you know, we were saying at the top of the show, the whole notion that teenage boys are in crisis, I think that sort of lends itself to kind of what you're talking about, you know. And I didn't, you know, again, we're going in a different direction, but again, the notion that if you are a loner, that means that your life is absolutely horrible and terrible and you're sullen and nihilistic, it's not necessarily true.
Thank you.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you for the question.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. A couple of other things that come through in the book, the importance of loyalty and secrecy. You want to give us a quick little riff on those two themes?
Quick little riff. Well, loyalty, I think loyalty is probably one of the most undersold qualities about boys. And the boys talk about that, how they are very loyal friends, and they believe that they are more loyal than some of their female counterparts. They believe that girls could talk behind their backs and, you know, say wonderful things to each other's face, but then, you know, turn around and say something completely different, and they felt that they didn't do that. And also about secrecy, well, there's a lot of things that we all keep to ourselves and we don't share with others. And a lot of times what these boys are keeping secret is not, they're keeping it secret not because nobody's asking them the right questions necessarily, but because secrecy is a source of kind of power and strength and maturity. As you become an adolescent, you learn that secrecy can be power. Mm. You understand that you can keep things secret, and that gives you kind of a leg up on other people. You don't have to share everything with anyone else.
Yeah.
You can develop your own identity. You can keep certain things just to yourself. And so this whole notion that actually secrecy is bad actually tried to show through these boys that that's not necessarily so. You need secrets to help form your character. And at a certain level, you're not going to hear everything about your kids because
yeah.
they're not going to tell you. And what can you do? You can't wrestle it out of them necessarily. And not all secrets are bad. There are some secrets that these boys have that they're just personal issues and personal just things about themselves, you know,
yeah.
they don't want to discuss. They just want to keep them close to their chest, so to
yeah.
speak.
I've got another caller waiting to talk with us, but to sum up here, I think that these secrets, good and bad, are a way to work through indecision and to
Absolutely.
Develop confidence.
Absolutely.
Because you yeah. got to work through it.
Absolutely, yes. And you can, if you share all of your stuff with everybody, then it sort of pollutes the process of discovering who you are.
As well as the room.
Yeah.
let's talk with another caller. Listener in Colfax, line 4, hi.
Yes, thank you for the interesting discussion. I have a question for you, or if you would mind commenting. I have a thoughts on this, having a daughter and a son, that boys are taught differently than mm-hmm. girls, and whether it's inadvertent or not. But it seems to me my son is like 5 years younger than my daughter, and at when they were growing up in that teenage years, boys were not given the responsibilities that they were, given in the past, and leadership roles, and that has an effect on their self-esteem, and you know, pretty much in his school, girls were all the officers and the leaders of the, and the boys were perfectly willing to say, oh, well, gives us time to mess around and do other things. I didn't know if you had any comments on that, because it seems to me boys need responsibility, and they have to learn how to be leaders, even with shared responsibilities.
Interesting what you're saying, because I actually did not find that. Pretty much across the board, a lot of these boys, they gladly accepted responsibility and leadership opportunities in the way of things at school, in the way of organizations, in the way of taking charge. I have one boy in the book who's a staunch vegan and animal rights supporter, and he was absolutely on the bandwagon. I have another student who his chapter is called The Sheltered One. He was in the choir, and he actually ran a bunch of school organizations to combat bullying. These boys showed a great deal of initiative, so I'm actually fascinated that you feel that that's not true. Of course, some boys, but I actually want to challenge you on one other thing when you say boys need to be leaders. I would challenge that, because some boys, you can be a follower, not be a weak person necessarily. You don't have to be a leader. Mm-hmm. You could actually wisely choose different directions in which to go and decide to take part that way. I don't think every human being is meant to be a leader. But that doesn't mean that you need to, make bad choices and follow the wrong path. Also, I definitely think that, reiterate, sorry, there's just so many ways in which a boy can exhibit strength. But I do want to address when you said that a lot of boys are taught the wrong things, and I'm assuming you meant in school in terms of the structure of the school, because there is one chapter, there's a couple of chapters, but one chapter in particular called The Mini Adult, in which he talks about his relationships with teachers, and it hasn't always been the most productive one. And I do mention there are some statistics about the majority of females teaching boys and how the structure for boys is not necessarily the best structure for teenage boys in the classroom. And there are a lot of issues there that one can make about how boys are not being taught in the way that they should. Boys are more tactile than girls. And again, there's so much we could talk about the ways in which boys are educated in our culture. But just to get back to your main point, I think that, A, I met a lot of boys who are leaders, and, B, if a boy isn't a leader, then that's okay, because that just might not be his personality, and we shouldn't push boys to be leaders if they're not, mm-hmm. just as we shouldn't push girls to be leaders if they're not. But we have to, hopefully they're going to make right decisions based on, make healthy choices.
Somebody's got to follow. It's got to get done.
Yeah, I mean, we can't all be leaders. Some of us can be really excellent followers and be strong in that way.
Yeah. There, we've got to wrap it up. We're out of time. Melina, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much, too.
Melina Saval is the author of The Secret Lives of Boys. The book is published by Basic Books. You'll find her online at www.melinasaval.com, M-A-L-I-N-A, Melina Saval, S-A-V-A-L. It's 1:54. Settlement prices in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much. Let's take a look at the numbers in Chicago. On a Tuesday afternoon, futures in the wheat pit were lower in the nearby contracts. July down 5 cents. That harvest month had a high today of $6.73 and a quarter, a low at $6.58 and a quarter, and a settlement price at $6.69 and a half cents, a nickel lower for the July soft red winter wheat in Chicago. September futures 4 and a half cents lower, $7. The high, the low at $6.84 and three quarters. Settlement price down 4 and a half at $6.96 and a half for the step. December contract 7.21 and a half, the high, the low at $7.07 and a quarter. Settlement price at $7.19 and a half, down 3 and a half cents. And in Kansas City, the hard red winter wheat finished the nearby July, the harvest month, down 7 at $7.19. July corn futures 4.50, the high, the low at 4.40 and a half, a settlement price at 4.49 and a half, 3 and three quarters higher. September 4.60 on the high, the low at 50 and three quarters, settlement price at $4.59 and three quarters, up 4 cents. In December futures 4.73 and a half, the high, the low at 64, settlement price at 4.72 and three quarters, up 3 and a half cents. March contract 4.83 and a half, the high, the low at 74 and a quarter, settled at $4.83, up 4 cents. And May futures 4.90, the high, the low at 4.81 and a quarter, settlement price at 4.90 and a quarter, up 4 and one quarter. July oat futures for the day 2.60 and a half, a settlement price up 6 and a half cents. September at 2.69 and three quarters, up 6 and one quarter. Soy complex now. July beans $12.21 and three quarters, the high, the low at $12.5, settlement price at $12.09, down 9 and a half cents. August 6 cents lower, $11.80 and a quarter, the high, the low at $11.60 and a half, nearly a 20 cent trading range, and a settlement price at $11.69 and a half, down 6 cents. September futures 11.20 and a quarter, the high, the low at $11.05 and three quarters. September soybean 11.15, down 6 in the November. That's the new crop harvest month. $10.87 the high, low at $10.73 and a quarter, settlement price at $10.82 and a half, down 3 and a half cents. January beans 10.89, the high, the low at 77 and a half, a settlement price at $10.87 and a half, down 1 for the day. And the March contract 10.81, down a penny in the bean pit. Bean meal futures for the day, July futures 3.92, the high, the low at $383.20 a ton, settlement price 387.50, down 3.30. August bean meal 370 and 40 cents, the high, the low at 363.60, and a settlement price at 367.80. August bean meal down $1.80. July bean oil 40.53, the high, the low at $39.94, settlement price $40.50. Finished 5 cents higher, the August up 6 cents at 40.67. I'll return at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock, 9 minutes away now. During the closing market report, we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities and get a complete update of what's happening in the 5 top corn-producing states around the Midwest. And we'll hear from Harry Cooney at GrowMark about the agricultural energy markets. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Livestock contracts finish lower on the day today, with feeder cattle finishing limit down and almost all of the lean hogs contracts finishing limit down. Live June cattle, the high today 88.87 and a half, the low 79.25, the settlement 79.27 and a half, that down 125. August 81.85, the high 80.40, the low 80.65, the settlement, that down $1. October 87.45, the high 85.90, the low 85.95, the settlement, down 130. December 89.80, the high 88 even, the low, the settlement 88.12 and a half, down 175. August feeder cattle $100.07 and a half, the high, the low and the settlement 97.17 and a half, that down $3. September $100.10, the high, the low and settlement 97.32 and a half, that down 3. October $100.55, the high, the low and settlement 97.67 and a half, that down 3. November $100.40, the high, the low and settlement 97.65, down the limit. June lean hog 61.65, the high, the low and settlement 59.75, that down 3. July 63.85, the high 62.15, the low and settlement down the limit. August 64.75, the high 63.05, the low and settlement down 3. October lean hog 61.10, the high 59.10, the low 59.15, the settlement, that down 242 and a half. And July belly 71.40, the high 68.70, the low and settlement, that down $3. The Dow is currently up 38 at 8760. The NASDAQ up 11 points at 1840. The S&P 500 up 4 at 947. And crude oil nearby month in New York trading up 17 cents at 68.75. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana. WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall, for public telecommunication. A severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar,